We're going to talk about, in an indirect way, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly, a man by the name of Timothy. Timothy was mentioned in the Scriptures, and he's introduced to us in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 16, Paul meets Timothy, and through his ministry begins to be acquainted with him. And it's interesting what it says there in just a few short verses. It tells us that Timothy was an outstanding individual, and he was an individual that was already in the faith. He had been acquainted with the Scriptures, and people in the community there, you lived in the area of Lystra and Derbe and those areas, and they were familiar with him, and he stood out. There were things about him that caused him to stand out to other people that were in the faith. And when Paul came, he made the same observation that this was a very special person, an outstanding individual. Paul took this man under his wing and began to mentor him. And what did Paul see in Timothy? He saw that Timothy was a genuine person. He wasn't putting on airs. He was not a fake or fraud. He was genuine. He was sincere. He was a person that, you know, what you saw was what you got, and there was nothing fake about him. And he stood out among the disciples in Galatia. And Paul saw in this young man that he stood out, and he needed assistance, and he was a young man that could be of assistance to him as an apostle. And so Timothy learned from Paul. And through learning from Paul, he became a most effective pastor. And we know that because Paul, that he was an effective pastor because Paul entrusted him with large church congregations. He would leave Paul in a particular place and say, leave Timothy in a particular location. And he would know that Timothy would properly take care of the flock there. He left him in Ephesus and in Corinth. And he sent Timothy to various congregations to try to help them with some of the challenges that they were facing. So we see that Timothy did grow. He developed. He was an individual that was blessed with the ability to preach the gospel. Well, that's why he's called an evangelist, one who goes forth and preaches the gospel of the kingdom of God. So let's pick up this story, what Paul has to say about this young man in 2 Timothy chapter 1. So this, I mean, you may be thinking this is going to be a biography, but it's not. Thinking about Timothy helps to lead in on what we are going to focus on today. 2 Timothy chapter 1, beginning in verse 3. 2 Timothy 1, let's begin in verse 3. Paul says here, he's writing to Timothy, who by this time is a minister in the church, and he says, "I thank God, whom I serve with a pure conscience, as my forefathers did, as without ceasing I remember you in my prayers night and day." So Paul is a servant in the church, and he says that he seeks to do so in the purest way that he can, and he prays without ceasing for Timothy and other members in the church. He says, "Greatly desiring to see you." So he loved Timothy and thought very highly of him and would like to be able to see him, being mindful of your tears that I may be filled with joy. So he knew that Timothy was a sincere individual, a person who had emotion and could be moved by challenges and difficulties that people in the faith, including Paul, had. And at this particular time, what was Paul's state? Paul was in prison. Paul was in prison. He was no longer able to go out and fulfill his ministry, and Timothy was well aware of that, and he besought God and shed tears over Paul's condition. He says in verse 5, "When I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you." So he could see it on display that this young man was faithful. He believed it, and he lived it. And it came out in a way that was on display among the brethren, and that Paul could see himself. And he was doing that before Paul ever came there. He didn't do it just to impress Paul or to gain office or to impress somebody for some personal gain. He was already doing this, offering service to the people there locally. And he grew up in a family where his mother was in the faith and his grandmother was in the faith, and they believed it as well. And so they were probably the example that he looked to and said, you know, my mom's in the faith, my grandmother's in the faith. And they taught him, and he was able to implement those things that he taught him. And it's a most positive story. But we make note of all of those things, and we look at, then go on to verse 6. And we see here it says, therefore, you've got all these good things going for you. And he says, therefore, I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. Stir up the gift of God. And he's giving him telling him that he needs to take note that maybe he's not doing as well as he should, and to stir up the gift of God. And so he needed to stir that up. And he goes on to say in the next verse, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. So as I said, Paul was a prisoner in Rome at this particular time. That's the context of writing 2 Timothy. And he told Timothy in chapter 4 that this might be the end of it for him, that his life may come to an end. And he basically said there that, you know, I await my crown, so if it is God's will that I die, then I will die. Paul in all of this saw that Timothy had some doubts. That's why he's saying this. This young man that has so much ability and has so much to contribute, and Paul has worked with him and spent time with him, taken him under his wings. But here at the end of his life, he's looking at Timothy and he's seeing that Timothy's not doing so well. That Timothy has some doubts and he's seeking to shore up this young man. Timothy was a young man and he did not have the maturity and the experience that Paul did. So he would naturally be fearful of what lay ahead. He was fearful about what was going to happen to the Apostle Paul. He had fears about the future of the church. He had fears about his own future. And he didn't know how things were going to go. He was not sure of that. I'm sure it went through his mind with the conditions that were with Paul, a prisoner in Rome, he may have thought, is this whole thing over? Now, he had come to believe that Jesus was the Messiah. He had a genuine faith, as we've seen. And he probably had a certain view, based upon the time that he came into the church, about how things were going to work out. It was probably in his mind that Christ had died for the sins of mankind, and Christ had promised his disciples that he would come again. So he probably had it in his mind, hey, the apostles are going to do their work. They're going to prepare the way for the second coming of Christ. And it won't be long before Christ is here. And unfortunately, that wasn't going to happen. That wasn't going to happen. Paul saw far beyond that view that Christ was going to come in a short time. We have some indication that some of the people living in Paul's time said, hey, Christ is coming back any time and his return is imminent. But as you look through Paul's writings, he started out with the viewpoint that Christ was coming soon. But his life went on and his ministry went on and he came to the point of seeing it's not going to happen. Not in my lifetime. It is going to happen. But he's not going to come right away. It's going to be a much longer wait that we have for the return of Jesus Christ. And he mentions that in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians and in other places in his writings. So Paul is telling Timothy, things are going to go on. You have to carry on the work of preaching the gospel and serving the church. And he seeks to tell Timothy what he needs to expect. What he needed to expect. What he as a servant of God needed to do. He's giving him advice on how to proceed and protect the church to ensure that the gospel continues to be preached. So what did Paul tell Timothy to do in the event that he did not see him again? What did he say? There are six things that he mentioned. The first one was, he said, hold fast the pattern of sound words which you have heard from me. He said, I received certain teaching from Jesus Christ. He taught me directly. I was as one born out of time. He taught me directly. And I tried to pass along those teachings to you. And don't change those things. You know what I said, and you know where I stand. Hold fast to those things and continue to teach them in the church. The second thing that he told him was commit these things that I've taught you to faithful men who can teach so the gospel can be carried forward from one generation to another. You want to entrust faithful men. See, what is Timothy going to be looking for? He's going to be looking for people that, just like he was found by Paul, people that stood out in the congregation because of their dedication, because of their service, because of their faithfulness. And what's interesting is my observation has been let's say you're going to ordain someone, and I may have a certain observation about ordination, but I'm not infallible. But what we've done is we've said, we put it out to the congregation, who would you ordain? So everybody gives their input and why. And then we've looked at the input. Nobody's given names or any of that. And what we found is that they basically concurred with our thoughts, because guess what? They can see the same thing we do. They can see the faithfulness and the service, and you'll recognize somebody that has the qualities of a shepherd, because they will have been shepherding you, serving you, helping you. So you observe as well as I do. So he says, commit these things to faithful men, men who you know as will faithfully carry on and teach the truths that I've taught you. So it's going from Paul, it was going from Christ, really, Christ to Paul to Timothy. And after Paul's demise, then it would go on to others that would be able to contribute to the church. He thirdly tells Timothy to beware of some men. Timothy, you need to realize that there are going to be people who will be your enemies, people who are going to try to change the truth. They will attack the church. They're going to attack you, and you can't let these things dismay you, because those are just part and parcel of being a leader in the church. And it's sometimes not easy, but you have to realize that this is coming and be aware of it and seek God's strength in order to deal with it. The fourth point he made to him was shun profane and idle babblings. He said, simply don't get into a lot of things that are not biblical. And there are all sorts of things that wind their way through the church, and we can argue about them and debate them. And he says, don't get into those things. Don't even allow yourself to be drawn into those kinds of conflicts, because nobody is edified in that process. Fifthly, he told Timothy, evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse. Evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse. And this is a serious issue for the church. He's saying to Timothy, as a pastor and leader, you have to be careful of imposters, people who profess to be Christians or put themselves across as Christians, but they're not really Christians. And time usually has to play out before you can really recognize that. But you need to be aware that this is a possibility and something that you may have to deal with. And the sixth thing he said is preach the word. Preach the truth. That's what he was called to do. Preach the truth. Paul also went on in 2 Timothy chapter 3 to talk about what the times at the end of the age would be like. He said, this is the way it's going to be in the latter days. Times will be perilous. Paul did not exactly know when that would be, but he said these are going to be the qualities that you will find in that time. And many of those qualities, sadly, we see in our particular time. So we have to understand the context of the letter. And why take the time to explain the context of what Paul is telling a younger man in the church? A much younger man who was being thrust into a situation that he never, ever would have chosen. And that's how it is sometimes. We are thrust into a situation that we would prefer not to be in. I know that I was happy, just as a personal example, I was more than happy to go to, I like camp and participated in camp, and I had was more than happy to go to camp and do my job at camp and enjoy the camp experience, but I did not want to be in charge. Just fundamentally, I saw, you know what? He has a hard job, and I don't want that hard job. So, right or wrong, I didn't want it. Because there's a lot, too, being a camp director, so I'm saying, I'm glad you're doing it, and I'm willing to help, but I don't want that job. But you know, things changed, and I got an email that said, hey, there's going to be a meeting on this day at this time, and there was no invitation, there was no, hey, would you like to do this? They didn't ask, because I might have said no. So anyway, they just said, you're going to be doing this. So I thought, oh, man. So I told my wife, well, if I'm going to do, my wife had never gone to camp because she was had a job and couldn't go. So anyway, when I got this invitation, I said, well, I'm not doing this unless you help me. And so she said, okay. And so I think she enjoys camp. But that first year, she probably regretted it. But there was a lot to do, and you're learning things that you'd never been through before. And you as a worker camp don't have the same responsibilities as a camp director, not to toot my own horn. But if I had had the opportunity, I think I would have turned it down. But you know, things come along sometimes, and you're thrust into it, and you begin doing things that, well, I never planned on this. Sometimes you're a grandparent and you become a parent again. And you're like, I did my time. But you don't have a choice. You're thrust into it. And so you seek to step up to the plate and take on the responsibility, whatever it is. And that's what was happening here. Paul, in all likelihood, was going to be executed. And I'm not sure whether he was executed here in the context of 2 Timothy, or he was actually freed by the emperor and died a few years later. But there's some conjecture about that. But Timothy had a formidable challenge ahead of him. And, you know, when you work with somebody, you know, if there's a tough situation comes up, what do? Hey, look, I'm not the head guy. You need to talk to him. You need to talk to Paul. He'll take care of it. And you may even, as an assistant to the Apostle Paul, say, you know what? I think Paul kind of botches some of this. You know, if I was in charge, we'd really make this train run on time. Now, I know that that's said because as I served with other ministers, I said the same thing. And then when I became a pastor, I'm like, I can't make that train run as well as I thought it could. As well as a lot of other stuff that I realized I couldn't do. So Timothy is being thrust into a very difficult situation, a situation that he has been prepared for, but he does not have the confidence for. So that's why Paul is saying to stir up the spirit. So let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 1 and look at verse 8. Paul says here to him there, therefore do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me, his prisoner. Don't be ashamed of me. I may be in prison. But I have the true testimony of God. Don't be ashamed of the testimony of Jesus Christ, and don't be ashamed of me, his prisoner. But share with me in the sufferings. You know, you may not be in prison here with me, but help me, pray for me, and if you are able to assist me, please do so. But share with me in the sufferings for the gospel according to the power of God. So what's Paul saying here? He's telling Timothy that the gospel is never going to freely go out into this world because of the natural opposition that exists to the things of God. If it's going to go out, it will only go out because of the power of God. It's not going to go out because of money, because of numbers, because of our eloquence. It's going to go out through the power of God. And, you know, even if we're clever and even if we have a sincere and intense desire to preach the gospel, that doesn't mean it's going to do any good. It's a matter of God and His power and His might. So it's going to be done because God will see to it that it's done, and He will use those whom He chooses to do the work. And sometimes He may choose somebody that really wouldn't want to do it, but it's His choice. Were there any reluctant prophets and servants of God? Do you think Moses would have turned it down? Now, he may have been happy to walk out of Egypt with the Israelites, but he would have been happy to be back in the pack. He didn't demand to be up front. Were there any reluctant prophets? Oh, yeah. Especially once they got into it and said, "Hey, God, I didn't realize there was going to be all this opposition. Maybe I can bow out." But God said, you know, to Jeremiah as an example, "I know you want out, but you're in and you're going to finish this. I know it's not pleasant." So we have a world that is hostile to God's message. And if you're going to be His messenger, there may be some difficult times. So because this is going to be a difficult path ahead of Him to preach the gospel, it's going to be a difficult path to pastor the church and oversee the church. Not just one congregation, but multiple congregations. And you're going to have to see to it that there are elders there, and that those elders are faithful and that they're carrying out their responsibilities. You're going to be the one that's writing the letters, just like I did. So Paul says the following to Timothy, as I said, "Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands." So a question. Were those gifts growing weak in Timothy? Were those gifts that had been bestowed upon Timothy growing weak? There were gifts that were given at the time of his ordination. It speaks about his ordination in 1 Timothy chapter 4, and Paul was there at that ordination service and laid hands upon him. And certain gifts were requested by God, and gifts were given to him. And as you think about the gifts being given to Timothy as a minister, and you think about the overall approach in the church, and we have to realize that God has to provide the gifts in and amongst the leadership of the church so the church can continue. God is the one who pours out the gifts. He has to give those gifts to those who are going to be His servants. And without those gifts, the church is going to suffer. Without those gifts, the church is going to suffer. You have to have people who will stand up for the faith. People who will stand up and preach the truth even though it's not popular. You know, we have to preach the truth even though we don't want to hear that. Yeah, you may not want to hear it, but if it's what you need, then you have to speak about it. You have to address it. And that's how the gospel is going to go out. You have to have people that are willing to do it. They're willing to stand up and preach the gospel. So the church has to be sustained by these gifts. And so God gives the gifts to individuals who can serve the congregation. And in Ephesians 4, it talks about Christ providing the leadership of the church. Christ is very much involved in it, and He gives the leaders that the church needs. He's very aware of His people. It doesn't matter which gifts God bestows upon us. You know, as you think about those gifts, you may be given gifts, and that's a wonderful thing. But you have to use those gifts, and you have to seek God in order that those gifts can develop and grow. And they aren't going to just grow if you don't use them or you don't apply yourself to them. So they need a great deal of personal attention and care in order that those gifts can be developed and really become an asset to the church. So why is Paul telling Timothy these things? Because Paul had come to perceive that Timothy was losing heart. And Paul is saying, "I want to remind you, this is what you have to do. And if you don't do this, if you don't do these things, the alternative is not going to be good for you or God's people. So you're either going to be led and directed by the Spirit of God or not. It's your choice. And God has given you those gifts, so use them to the benefit of the church." And then he goes on in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, it says, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. He's not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. So why does Paul write this verse? I would say it's obvious that Timothy was fearful. Timothy was fearful. And why was Timothy fearful? Well, he realized, I'm not mature, and I've not pastored as long as Paul had. I haven't had all those experiences. How can I step into Paul's shoes? How can I carry on in a faithful ministry as effectively as Paul? And filling Paul's shoes was a large task. And so there was fear there. And all of us live in this world. We all have to live in this world, and we all have our lives, minds, and hearts attacked and assaulted by the world. And people living in the world are intimidated by the world, and all of us are subject to fear to one degree or another. We all are afraid of various things. Some more, some less, but we all have our fears. We're not strong enough to withstand the world, and we need something very powerful to help us. Paul did, Timothy did, we all do. And we don't know what the future holds exactly. Do we? How many of you know what the future holds? I don't. Not exactly. And all of a sudden, we can be on our own. You know, if you're married, you can be on your own. There is no spouse there. The world falls apart, which we look at the world and we wouldn't be surprised if it falls apart, but it's not going to be easy. And not only can the world at large fall apart, but our own world can fall apart. We can lose our job. Things can happen that wipe out all that retirement that we've saved. Hey, we're in pretty good shape. We're financially set. And whoosh, it's gone. It's gone. So we have other things. We discover we have a severe disease, or we lose everything, as I said. And some people thought that they had friends, and their friends would always be there for them, and they turn out not to be there for them. And things falling apart can tend to shake people. They can intimidate us. So as things don't go the way that we thought they would, we can become discouraged and overwhelmed by all of it. Sometimes as we look out from our particular situation, we can look out and we can see, you know, they're all doing fine. They're not following God, but they're not dealing with all the challenges I have. That's a perspective we can have. We're struggling, we're striving, but they don't seem to be, and it doesn't seem fair. And trust me, you know, you can't see the whole picture. And just because somebody seems like they're doing well doesn't mean that they are. You don't know all the details. And sometimes people that, you know, we see people that are wealthy, we see people that are powerful, and we think, man, their life is a dream. It's all wonderful. But when you really unmask them, you find out, wow, it's not as good as I thought it was. In fact, I'm glad I don't have their life, because their life is a nightmare. I just didn't see it. So there are plenty of reasons why doubts can come along and impact a person's thinking. They can zap our zeal, our energy. They can cause us to become discouraged and depressed. And we can become fearful and uncertain. And what Paul is referring to when he says that God did not give us a spirit of fear. Now, have you ever thought about the spirit of fear? It's not just fear, it's the spirit of fear. There is a spirit of power, and there's a spirit of love, and there is a spirit of a sound mind, and there's also a spirit of fear that is installed within human beings. Now understand, it is through fear that we are controlled. It is through fear that we are controlled. It is through fear that we are controlled by Satan. A spirit of fear does not come from God. A spirit of fear comes from Satan. And normally, You may not be afraid of anything. You're pretty bold. You're pretty courageous. But we all have fears. You know, and the thing is, God has not given us a spirit of fear. Sometimes when there are things looming in front of us for which we have no answer, then we can begin to fear because, you know what, we don't know the answer. We don't know what to do. Probably all of us have experienced that. There are things that happen in our lives and we don't know what to do. Which path should we go? We wonder, what should I do? And God allows us to face those situations. You know, we think, I always thought it was going to be a certain way. I always thought it was going to work out a certain way. And, you know, think about how many of you came into the church in the worldwide Church of God? How many of you came? Okay, how many of you thought, you can put your hands down, how many of you thought when you came into that church, and it's the only true church, and you found out those truths, that that was going to be what you were a part of till Christ returned? Any of you think that? I did. But you know what? It didn't work out that way. So does that mean that we were wrong? Yeah, we were wrong, but it's all working out. It's all going to work out, but it doesn't always work out the way we think it's going to. And if it doesn't work out the way that we think, you know, if you were back in the church in maybe 1972 and they were talking to you that Christ is going to return in 1972 and you're reading 1975 in prophecy, there were people who said, yeah, this is a sure thing. And guess what? As far as I know, this is 2017, and it has been a few years since 1975. So obviously, Christ did not return unless we missed it big, you know. And we didn't miss it. It's going to be so momentous and so huge that everybody will see it. But we can see things don't work out the way that we think they do, and we can become discouraged, we can quit, we can decide, I'm not going to do this anymore. And lots of people have made that decision. Many of them have been motivated by fear. They've been motivated by fear. And you know, fear is something many of us face all the time. You know, people think that, you know, ministers love calling members up and letting them know they're wrong. All right? I love doing that. Because I'm always received positively, and it always goes, there is no hostility there. Nothing could be further from the truth. If I have to call somebody or need to deal with something, I don't want to. I don't want to do it. I try to convince my wife to go do it, but she usually says, it's your job. So, and she's right. But I don't want to do it because I'm afraid to do it in a way. Because I know this is going to be difficult, it's going to be challenging, and I don't want to do that. I would prefer not to. But you know what? You've been called to take care of a job, and even though it's thankless sometimes, you got to do it. That's your job as a pastor of a church. And if you are motivated by fear and won't do your job, then maybe you need to find a new job. But I'm fearful. I was fearful about speaking. I didn't want to speak. The last thing I wanted to do when I came into the church was to be a minister and stand up here. I did not want to do that. The crazy thing about that whole scenario was, I wanted to be a teacher. And guess what? If you're a teacher, I think you have to do public speaking. So something was missing in my analysis of my future employment. So anyway, it all worked out. And I got up and I spoke. Nobody was impressed. And it wasn't necessary. It was an endurance test for years for members in the church. But you know what? You learned, you grew, and you got better at it. Could I get better? Yes. But the other thing is, you also realize that you overcame that and you were able to progress with it, so you learn, I can take on other things. Things that are thrust my direction. So Paul had confidence that Timothy could carry on and was confident that he could do it. So the world is hostile to those who live a godly life. So if you're a member of the church, the world at times is going to be hostile. If you're going to be a person who serves God by preaching the truth, you may face more hostility than the general membership might, because you're out front. And that takes a special person that God will give gifts to in order to handle that. And Paul is telling Timothy, you know what? You've been given that gift. You need to use it, and God is going to be with you. You're going to face some challenges, but don't be fearful. Let's look at fear. How does Satan exercise control over people? It's through fear. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 2. Hebrews chapter 2. And let's begin in verse 14. Paul here is speaking, and he says in verse 14, "Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood," so we the children of God have partaken of flesh and blood, "he himself likewise shared in the same." So Jesus Christ became a flesh and blood human being and experienced the same. "That through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil." Satan is a destroyer. And he, through influencing us to sin, he doesn't make us sin, but he influences us. And we sin, and he rejoices in the fact they're going to die. They're going to suffer the death penalty. But he came, and he destroyed him who had the power of death, that is the devil. That's why Christ came in verse 15, "and released those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage." How many people are afraid of death? Almost all of us are. We're afraid of death, and being afraid of death is a reason why people do a lot of things, especially in totalitarian states. You know, if you happen to be a Christian in a Muslim part of the world, then you're either going to make a financial contribution, or you're going to become a Muslim, or you're going to die. And when you're told you're either going to accept Islam or die, many people accept Islam. And sometimes that's the way it used to be with Christianity. You either become a Christian or you die. But a lot of people are motivated by death, and they're motivated by death to escape. You know, when people are threatening your home, your life, you seek to escape. You seek to become a refugee. You'll move someplace else in the hope that you can find a place that's safe. So a lot of people are motivated by the fear of death all their lifetime. And being fearful of death is a bondage. It is a bondage. But we are told as Christians, it says in verse 16, "For indeed he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham." Those who are walking in faith like Abraham, God helps them deal with the fears and overcome the fears and not be in bondage to fear. So Satan has control over this world, and God has limited his control, thankfully. He's able to do a lot of devastating things, and thankfully he's bound in Tartaru, in a sense, where he can only go so far. But boy, he can go as far as that chain will allow him to make life miserable for human beings. Satan has the ability to influence people to engage in warfare. And it's amazing how much warfare has taken place throughout man's history. All of the carnage and the death and the destruction. Satan's quite influential, and he has no problem with killing people. And as I said, we all have a natural fear of death. We try to avoid it. We try to prolong our lives. You know, as we find out that we have a health problem, don't we all fear dying? And if you don't take care of it, you're not going to be around. And we all, you know, we find out, well, I need to lose weight. I need to get in shape, whatever it may be, to prolong our lives. Once somebody tells you, if you don't take care of this, you aren't going to be around long. For instance, my brothers and I, my dad was a smoker from the age of 12 and smoked a lot. And he didn't like low-octane cigarettes. He wanted the really powerful ones. And so he would get the smokes that were pipe tobacco and different things. So anyway, he liked the more potent smokes. So anyway, but he was smoking, and he would show us the example of, you know, sucking the cigarette through a handkerchief and all the black stuff there. Don't do this. Don't get started with this. So we finally said, "Hey, Dad, you know, you're telling us not to do this. Why do you keep doing it?" It was an interesting confrontation, my brothers and I. Why don't you quit? You know, I think it was Father's Day, and we said, you know, the greatest Father's Day present you could give us if you'd quit smoking. And you know what? He quit. And it was a tough go. He had Trident gum in his pocket all the time, so he couldn't get the pack of cigarettes out there, but he'd go get the gum. And he was one nervous individual when he quit. And it's hard to do. But the thing is, Satan is there, and he's seeking to keep us in bondage. And through fear of death, he's able to get us to do various things. Think about our Adam and Eve. Were they motivated by fear? Were they motivated by fear? I may be motivated by fear, depending on what that is and how close it gets. But anyway, were they motivated by fear? Now think about the fact that they are able to interact with God. They see Him. They talk to Him. And there's no indication of fear. None whatsoever. There's no fear of the animals. The fear is not an issue at that point. And then they're confronted by Satan. And it is interesting that he's called, you know, he appears as a serpent. Now for me, I'm deathly afraid of snakes. I do not like snakes. I don't like the way they writhe around and all of those other things that go on with the serpent. And so I try to stay away from them. And I don't want, you know, there are people that will pick them up. What's the problem? It's just a snake. Keep it away from me. I don't even want to know. But anyway, he appears to them as a serpent. So they're not afraid of God. He appears to them. And what does he do? How does he appeal to them? He said, you know what? God's not dealing straight with you. God's holding back on you. He's telling you you're going to die. You shall not surely die. So they sowed doubt. And part of the reason why they partook of that forbidden fruit was fear. They partook of that fruit. Part of the reason was fear. Fear that they were losing out some way, that God was holding back on them. And then once they had eaten of the forbidden fruit, what was their state in regard to God? Fear. They're hiding from God. They're covering themselves. They're afraid to interact with God. So fear becomes a real problem. So fear is a terrible thing. It can come out in a lot of different ways, such as a lack of confidence and inability to make a commitment. It can run through your mind, what price will I have to pay to be a Christian? There are people that will not become Christians because once you lay out for them, this is the path that you have to follow. And it may cost you your life. You may be persecuted. You're going to have to live within these bounds, which the world rejects. They think it's nonsense. But you're going to have to do this. And people see, I don't want to do that. People can say, well, I don't want to come into the church and be a part of that because I don't want to pay that price. And there are lots of people that walk away because of the price that they have to pay. And it is a big price. They pull back out of fear about sometimes they're married and their spouse says, if you go with this, we're done. And that happens. And that's a big step to say, you know what, I'm going to follow God and practice His way of life, even though it cost me my marriage. Or maybe you're rejected by your family. And they have been. It's not an easy thing to do. And Paul is running through these things with Timothy, trying to shore him up to help him to see this is, yes, this is the course that we have to go, but you committed to it and you've got to continue in it. And God's going to be with you through all of it. Let's look at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 Matthew chapter 10 would have been a wonderful chapter for Paul and Timothy to review as they think about the challenges that lay ahead of Timothy. And as you think about what's happening with Timothy, this is very applicable to what's going to take place with him. And as you think about your being a Christian, it applies to all of us, not just Timothy or to a minister. It applies to all of us. He says in verse 16, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." He's telling you just straight out, I'm sending you out into the midst of wolves. And think about that. What are you? You're being sent out into the midst of wolves. What are you? Well, I'm a tiger. I'm a lion. No, you're not. You're a sheep. And if you're a sheep and you're being sent out into the midst of wolves, I don't know whether I would, if I were a sheep, I'd say, hey, is there another way to go here? Because I don't want to be out there among the wolves. Because wolves tend to ravage sheep. So you're being sent out there, and what does Christ tell his disciples? He says, therefore, be wise as serpents. So serpents are pretty wise. They hide and they're able to conceal themselves and that, and be harmless as doves. Be gentle. So be wise, but also be gentle. He says in verse 17, beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. Yes, that's what you have to realize, that you're going to be singled out in your community. So if you were a Jew and you were taken before the council, you were held up to the community, the leadership of the community, and they're going to scourge you. And if you were scourged in the synagogue, the synagogue is your community. You weren't driving 100 miles to church. You're walking a short distance to where the synagogue is and meeting with those people. And they all know you. So you're being publicly put up to ridicule. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. So if you're preaching, you're out on the front line and you're preaching, you may be arrested and you'll be taken to officials, governors and mayors and others who will have jurisdiction over you. And he says, okay, so when this takes place, what are you going to do? Verse 19, but when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak. So when you get into that situation, what are you going to do? What are you going to say? He said, don't worry about it. What do you mean, don't worry about it? You don't think they're going to question me about what I believe and why I believe it and why I'm teaching these things? Yes, they're going to. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. He says, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. So if you find yourself in one of these predicaments where you've been arrested or you're being incarcerated because of your religious beliefs, and they begin to question you about those religious beliefs, don't worry about it. Should you pray? Absolutely. But ask for God's guidance in the way to respond. What is the best way to respond? And ask for His help and strength in responding, and God will give you the wisdom and the words that you need. Verse 21, now brother will deliver up brother to death, and father, his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. Your family's going to betray you? He says that's going to be a reality for some people in my church. Verse 22, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. Yeah, you're going to be hated. I don't think any of us wants to be hated. And they're going to punish us. They're going to persecute us. We may lose our jobs. We may not be able to operate in the economic system. Verse 23, when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. So, he says, look, these things are going to happen. They're going to come your way. And don't fear. Let's go down a little ways here. And he says in verse 28, chapter 10, verse 28. It says, and do not fear those who kill the body. Don't worry about those who can kill the physical body, but cannot kill the soul. They can't exterminate you permanently. They may end your physical life, but they can't end your life in the ultimate sense. But rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in the lake of fire. And that is God. He has the power to completely annihilate you. And some, unfortunately, will suffer that. Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will. Sparrows aren't worth much, but God knows about them. And God knows if one falls to the ground. He says, but the very numbers of the very hairs of your head are all numbered. For some of us, it's easier to do than others. So, but God knows them all, whether we have a full head or it's getting a little thin. He says, do not fear, therefore you are more value than many sparrows. And he tells them that death is maybe a reality, but don't fear it. Christ did not fear death. He did not fear death. And as you look at the Apostle Paul, look at his example. The Apostle Paul was told not to go to Jerusalem. They prophesied, don't go to Jerusalem because it's going to end badly for you. And they sought to convince him not to go, and he said, look, God called me and has seen me through all these years. I have a mission, I have a purpose, and I'm going to go. And he went. And he was arrested and ended up in Rome. Now, it ended up being for the betterment of the church, but it was not a positive experience for Paul and ended in his death. Paul was not willing to back down. He had a mission and a purpose, and he's, you know, that example is one that I'm sure he recounted to Timothy. You've got to do what you've got to do. You've got to do it. So, we see that taking place there, and we see that Christ tells him, don't be afraid. Let's go and look at what Paul further said in 2 Timothy. Let's go to 2 Timothy and just look at what he says there. So he's talked about them not having a spirit of fear. Don't have a spirit of fear, because when you're afraid, you don't make good decisions. When you're afraid and you make decisions, they aren't wise. They aren't wise. So you have to make a decision based upon sound judgment, based upon your belief in God, and you also realize that the course of life that I'm living as a Christian may end in my death. Paul was not afraid to die, and we all have to reach the same point. Christ was not willing to die either. Did Satan try to intimidate him? I'm sure he did. But Christ said, I know that your mission is to kill me, and you're going to. And that's perfectly okay. I'm willing to die physically, but you can't exterminate my life. So you may kill me, but I trust in my Father, and my Father said, I'll be in the grave 3 days and three nights, and He will raise me up. And you know what? When He does, you're done. I am going to rule as God has ordained, and you will no longer... Yes, you're going to be in have your kingdom here for a while longer, but I will have all power. So he wasn't intimidated in that, and we aren't to be either. So, 2 Timothy chapter 1, let's look here, it says, so he said, for God has not given us a spirit of fear. That's not what God has given to us. And so if we have fears, we need to analyze and think about them and ask for His strength. And he gives us a great encouragement in the rest of the verse. He said, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but He has given us a spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind. So what does that mean? He's given us a spirit of power and of love and a sound mind. The word, so spirit is there, and it's at the beginning of the verse, and then you have to bring the word spirit and tie it in with the spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind. So the word for a power is dunamis, from which we get dynamo and dynamic, and it means energy, it means power, it means strength or might. And what he's saying is, you don't need a spirit of fear, but you need the spirit of power. You need a spirit that will give you the strength and the power and the energy and the might to overcome anything that's fearful. And two things that Jesus Christ gave us, the first one is the church. He gave us the church to be a body of believers who would come together and fellowship and develop a community and that will help each other. That's what the church is to be. It's not just a building we show up to, but it's a group of people that have the same beliefs, and we come to know them and we come to interact with them and reach the point where we have a relationship with them, a community of people to be with, to give support and help. Christ said, "I will build my church." And we have to have a church. And as we pointed out a couple of weeks ago, the church will always be there to the end of the age. We, in whom God's Spirit dwells, we are the church. This is a building. And if God dwells in you, then you are a part of the body of Christ. You are part of the church. And we come together, and the purpose is to form a community, which is a hard thing to do. We'll talk more about that next week on Pentecost. The second thing that Christ gives us is you need to have me, that is Christ, in you. Jesus Christ said, "Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." So the one that is in us is one who has already faced the world and overcome it. Christ said, "I will send you another comforter." He says, "I and my Father will dwell in you." And he tells us in John chapter 15 about how we need to be tied into the vine. And he says, "Without me, you can do nothing." Without me, you can do nothing. And that is an important thing for all of us to realize. You think some people think that they're going to operate in the world apart from God. They think that they're going to live in this world and make it into the kingdom of God, and they don't really need God. You're deluding yourself. We all need God. We'll never make it without Christ in us. We're talking about eternal life, and we can do a lot as human beings. We can overcome things humanly, but that's just human accomplishment. For the spiritual things God wants to be developed in us, we need God dwelling in us through the Spirit. Without Christ living in us, we can do nothing. And Christ promised us that He would come. Isn't that what He promised His disciples, that He would come? Now, when He came, the question is, how many people saw Him come? A portion of them did, because God manifested it in a very dramatic way. But after that, how many very dynamic, powerful displays of God pouring out the Spirit took place? Very few. And when you were baptized, and you went up under the water, and you came up out of the water, and hands were laid on you, what happened? How many of you remember when that mighty rushing wind came through there, and that tongue of fire was over your head when you were baptized? All of you remember that, don't you? It didn't happen. I remember when I was baptized, I was out clipping ivy in Big Sandy, Texas. I was supposed to meet the minister up in the Redwood building at Big Sandy and be baptized. So I went up there. We did it. Nothing big happened. And I went right back out to work. And I thought, that wasn't that dramatic in one sense. And it doesn't have to be dramatic. People can't see it, but it begins to work in your life, even though there is no dramatic manifestation of God's Spirit being in you. And Christ promised that the Spirit would come, and most people couldn't see it. It was like the wind, but it began to dwell in those people and change them. All you have to do is look at pre-Pentecost, the disciples, and post-Pentecost. There's a very clear-cut change and difference between one and the other. So we talked about the Spirit, but what about the power that Paul speaks about? Let's go to this power, the Spirit of power. Let's look at 1 John chapter 4, verse 4. 1 John 4, verse 4. And this is quite an encouraging verse. It says in verse 4, "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." He who is in you is greater than he that's in the world. So who do you think it's referring to when it's talking about he that's in the world? He's talking about Satan. The Satan who is the one who spreads the spirit of fear in everybody. Think about current times. How much of what is taking place with the current president is based upon fear? All the political controversy and contention, how much of it is based upon fear? A lot. And it's very confusing and disturbing, and it'll be nice when all of that ends. But it's the world we live in. And the thing that's reassuring to us is that the he who is in you, that is Jesus Christ, is greater than he who is in the world. Satan can't stand up to him, and he's in us. One way we might look at it is, let's say that you're the quarterback of a team. You're quarterbacking, and there's a defensive back on the other side of the ball who is quite skillful. He's big, he's strong, and he's mean. And his goal is to get to you and tackle you before you can throw the pass or hand the ball off. His goal is to get to you, and if he possibly can, when he hits you, make sure you feel it. Make sure you know he's there. And the thing is, you see him, and he's telling you, "I'm going to get you, man. I'm going to, you know, when I get you, you're going to pay." So you're looking at him, and you know, this is not good. I really don't want him to hit me. So the thing is, on your team, you have somebody that's bigger, that's stronger, and he's going to make sure he doesn't get to you. And that's what you want. And that's what we have. We want somebody that's bigger, stronger, meaner, and is on our side. And is going to help us as we have to deal with Satan and the world and everything that we have to deal with. So he's bigger than anything that we can come up with. Any strategy, thought, good idea as to how to become better. None of them are that good, but we have Christ in us. And he has overcome the world, and he's greater than the world, and we can have confidence in him. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 3 and look at verse 16. Ephesians 3, verse 16. Ephesians 3, verse 16. Paul here says that he would grant you, that is, would God would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might through his Spirit in the inner man. See, we need to be strengthened through the Spirit in the inner man. That's what we need. He's talking about going to, he's not talking about going to some charismatic church, holding up our hands and falling backwards, or hearing rousing music. That's not what this is all about. It is God's Spirit dwelling in us. You've got to be strengthened with might through the Holy Spirit in the inner man. A power that's not outside of us, but inside of us. A power that gives us peace and resolve on the part of the individual. We know that he's in us. We know that he's with us. We know that we can stand up to whatever comes. We don't have to be afraid. There's going to be knowledge, and we know that he's with us. I know for me, just looking at it personally, there have been times when I've really been somewhat overwhelmed. And I thought, I don't need this anymore. I'm overwhelmed. I need to bow out of this. But I realize I need to do it, and so I've gone to God and said, "Please strengthen me," And for some reason, once you went to God and you looked at the scriptures and things and felt that reassurance, then okay, God's going to be with me, and this is all going to work out. It's all going to work out. Let's look at verse 17. It says that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you being rooted and grounded in love may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and the length and the depth and the height, to know the love of Christ which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with the fullness of God. Now to Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think according to the power that works in us. Power that works in us. To Him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus to all generations forever and ever. Christ is in us. And if He's in us, He's stronger than that spirit that's in the world. And He's going to help us to overcome. He's going to help us meet the challenges. He's going to help us to be at peace and to deal with any fears that we might have. So Christ is with us. What about the matter of love? What about the matter of love? When it talks about love, it's talking about that is you have an interest in another person at heart. That was the approach that Timothy had. Remember, Paul said, I have no man like-minded who will care for you except Timothy. Paul knew that if he sent Timothy to a church area, that Timothy would faithfully and lovingly serve that congregation. He knew that. He had confidence in him. And if God has called you out and brought you into the church, He knows that if you're yielded to Him and seeking to live by the Scriptures, that He can use you. He can have confidence in you in what you can offer the church. Timothy was that kind of a person. Timothy had the interest of the other person in heart. If Timothy were motivated by, well, I'm an evangelist. I'm a minister. I'm going to be an apostle. How do you think he would have done? He wouldn't have made it. He wouldn't have been effective. He would have failed. But he wasn't that kind of person. Let's look at Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 3. This is the type of person that Timothy was and we need to emulate. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. He says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. You know, if you're a servant in the church, you don't do it because of what you're going to get out of it or how you're going to look to other people. You do it because you have a heart of service, a heart of love and care for the others in the congregation. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Do you have to go through, you know, we deal with something as mundane as a potluck. Do you have to be first? Do we? Or you say, let others go. And I hope that there's some left for me. And that is a carnal area there when it comes to food. Sorry. And I know that we, just one incident here, my carnal nature came out intensely one time. This was a long time ago. We had a family over and we had bundt cake. My wife made a bundt cake, one of these round cakes. So what she said, we'll just have everybody go around and they can cut off a piece. And because they're guests, you let them go first. Getting awfully close here. And it's a wasp. So anyway, they're each cutting off their piece, and as they went, I'm going to be last. Sorry to be carnal, but they cut off a big hunk. I thought, man, that's a lot. And the next one cut off a big hunk. And everyone cut off a big hunk all the way around. I thought, Liz, you should have cut this up and distributed it differently, but it was the way it was. But I was worried about my portion of the pie there. Instead of being that person who was in lowliness of mind, that was not the case on that particular occasion. Let each esteem others better than himself. It's not about you, but you begin to think of others and think of them coming before you. And if they come before you, it's okay. You're comfortable with it. That's what God's looking for. That's the kind of person Timothy was. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. Think of others. What do they need? How do they feel? How will they be impacted by what I say or don't say or what I do or don't do? Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ. This was Christ's approach. We're following his example. And Paul sought to follow that example, and he sought to get Timothy to do that as well. And he wanted Timothy had shown those qualities, and he wants him to continue because it's vital for the church. Let's look at 1 John verse 17. 1 John chapter 4, verse 17. He says, love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. We love him because he first loved us. He set us the example of love, and we seek to follow that example and show love toward others. It is how the church grows. It is how the church is built. It is how we form a community. What about the sound mind? What is that all about? The sound mind. Quoting from William Barclay, he said, In the sound mind, his comment on 2 Timothy 1, verses 8 through 11, he said, it is Christ alone who can give us that self-mastery, which is what it's talking about when it talks about a sound mind, self-mastery, which will keep us alike from being swept away and from running away. No man can ever rule others unless he has first mastered himself. So we master ourselves. We have the discipline necessary. The Greek word there is that divinely given self-control, which makes a man a great ruler of others, because he is first of all the servant of Christ and master of himself. So the word there, a sound mind, is talking about sound discipline. Sound discipline. So self-discipline, a sound mind, is not swept away by the powerful influences of this world, not easily led along by basic human desires. He is able to make right decisions because he is grounded in the teachings of Jesus Christ. And when there are threats, you don't panic, but you seek God and his wisdom in dealing with it. So we are to be of sound mind, self-disciplined. And that is fundamental to our service to the church. So, we are to be patient, not impetuous, self-disciplined, sober-minded, a person of discretion and prudence, a mind that's balanced and under the right and correct influences. And that's what Paul is exhorting Timothy to develop. So we are to be strong in what we believe, and to discipline ourselves and have that sound mind that is crucial in difficult times. How many of you want to be with somebody when there's a difficult situation that panics? You want to be with somebody that's cool when there's a difficult situation and they're able to handle it. I'll always remember that we had a nurse that was at camp, and she had worked at the in the emergency room. And when you work in the emergency room, you're always dealing with difficult situations. Everyone is an emergency, a life or death situation many times. So when we had some of the things that happened at camp that were a little dicey, and I'm worried about it and thinking, oh, great, so this is all gone wrong. And you describe the situation to her, and she says, well, are they talking? Yeah, they were talking. Don't worry about it. It's fine. They're fine. Oh, okay. So anyway, she didn't panic. And even when it was a difficult situation, she didn't panic. And that's the kind of person you want to be with. They have a sound mind. They're able to step back and think about it and then rightly handle it. And that's what we want to do with spiritual things. So there are some, as we look at these things, we look at at what's described here in regard to Timothy, these are some things that we can grow in. And I hopefully that this has helped it to stand out more in your mind. Paul says, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. And I hope that you better understand what Paul is talking about in that context, and I hope that it will be encouraging to you. So please have a good remainder of the Sabbath day. We'll see you next Sabbath for Sabbath services at 2. We'll have Bible study, and then on Sunday we will finally meet on the right day. We'll have services on Sunday there for Pentecost at 10:30 in the morning. So please have a great week and a good remainder of the Sabbath.